Good evening, everybody. Welcome to the Free Library, which occupies Lenape Hoking, the territory and ancestral homeland of the Lenni Lenape peoples. Thank you so much. And thank you, Marie, for those words and for your 2 decades of service. It's been an honor and a delight to work with you. My name is Brittany Sterner. I'm the program director for One Book, and I would now like to introduce the authors. Lilian Rivera is the award-winning author of several young adult novels, including Dealing in Dreams, The Education of Margot Sanchez, We Light Up the Sky, the DC Comics graphic novel Unearthed, a Jessica Cruz story, and of course, Never Look Back, a Pura Belle Prix Honor winner, and the One Book, One Philadelphia 2022 Young Adult Companion Selection. Never Look Back recasts the Greek myth of Orpheus and centers Phias, a bachata singing charmer, and Yuri, who comes to the Bronx as a girl haunted by Hurricane Maria and by an evil spirit that she must fight to free herself from. The film adaptation of Never Look Back is currently in the works. Chiara Alegria Juris is the Pulitzer Prize-winning dramatist of Water by the Spoonful and screenwriter of the major motion pictures In the Heights and Vivo. Originally trained as a composer, she often writes at the intersection of music and drama. She wrote the Tony Award-winning musical In the Heights with Lin-Manuel Miranda, as well as Miss You Like Hell with Aaron McCohen. Her memoir, My Broken Language, the 2022 One Book, One Philadelphia featured title, builds an archive of family and community in North and West Philly in the 80s and 90s, depicting a city built upon the suffering as well as the wisdom and love of many communities. As she traces the evolution of her own artistic voice, she finds herself surrounded by many languages in many forms: English, Spanish, Spanglish, bodies and books, and Western art and sacred altars. I am so excited for tonight's conversation. Please join me in wildly welcoming Chiara Alegria Juris and Lilian Rivera.
Hello. Hello, beautiful people. Good evening. Hi, Lilian. I can't wait to be in conversation with Lilian. We're going to talk about our books. Hers is the young adult fiction that was chosen for One Book, One Philadelphia. Mine is, I guess, the all ages, but not too young book chosen for One Book, One Philadelphia. But of course, first I had to just, you know, grab the mic for a second and express how much my cup overflows here. A gratitude to the Free Library of Philadelphia. Here we are. Gratitude to Andy Cahan, who hosted my book reading a year ago when my book, My Broken Language, first came out. That was an online event. I'm so glad we can be here in person. Gratitude to Brittany Murphy, who runs One Book, One Philadelphia with thoughtfulness, grace, and full-spirited energy. And to the One Book, One Philadelphia Selection Committee. Gratitude to the city's taxpayers for funding this library. Gratitude to Mayor Kenny and the City Council for these very cool shout-outs they've been giving me these last few weeks. Pretty wild. Gratitude to SEPTA, who, I don't know if you can hear me. Can you hear me? Okay. Gratitude to SEPTA, who kept me waiting and therefore kept me reading. Gratitude to Faye Beecham, whose championing has never been required but always been cherished. Power Street Theater is in the house. Power Street. Philly Young Playwrights is in the house. Black Doctors COVID Consortium is in the house. And I have to give a special love to two people. So in the book, I make mention of the boy. I called him the boy because when you crush on someone that hard, saying their name can be a little dangerous. It can like bring on a tsunami of some stomach butterflies. So I wanted to capture that wild blend of horniness and innocence I felt during our first kiss. So I called him the boy. Ray Beecham and I met when we were 17, and I still really, really like him a lot. And finally, gratitude to Virginia Sanchez. You know, you think you know someone. I thought I knew my mom. But we received the, or I received the rough draft of the Spanish translation, Mi Lenguaje Roto. And my mom and I had to spend about 4 months doing another pass at the language to get the translation right. So her spiritual genius is something, her spiritual talents are something that I always admired, but a little bit from afar because I don't share those talents. All of a sudden, for 4 months, we were at a desk together and our talents overlapped. And it was an incredible experience. So you think you know someone. So are y'all ready to talk books?
Yes.
All right. I stand here, I want to indulge in a moment of reflection, if you will, and then get into this conversation with Lilium. I wanted to reflect on something that matters a lot to me. I stand here in this adolescent sanctuary of mine. I stand here in this hall because when I was a child, artists stood on my street corner. Since our city's great institutions rarely hosted these particular artists, they made the sidewalk a great Philly institution. That means anyone walking by, like myself, paid an annual subscription fee of $0 to become regulars in their season planning. Being lauded and honored did not seem to motivate these artists, nor validate them if and when it happened. Making a neighbor stop and listen, pause and notice, was their standing ovation, their rave review, and their prestigious award. So did you know there once stood a world-class music conservatory on Baltimore Avenue between 47th and 48th?
Yeah.
Now to the naked eye, it looked like a rundown lot of asphalt and rubble. And its architect was named Time. But here, the alfresco seminars of Adi Mukumba could be attending. Out of trash, out of what myself and my neighbors deemed worthless, Adi Mukumba made one-of-a-kind instruments on which he serenaded whoever was walking by. Marimbas, guicas, one-string basses, jequeres, guiros. Each one had a really cool sculptural look, and he learned to play each one virtuosically. So etiquette demanded my attentive ear, but it also earned me the right to ask for a turn. He'd position my thumbs on the metal kalimba slats, and I'd think, ouch, as I plucked them, and also, hey, these notes flow like water, and also, hell, he was right, you just play what you feel. So years later at Yale, I learned about pentatonic mode, but this West Philly girl been knowed that. Adi Mukumba's parking lot was my original Ivy League education, though there were only dandelion weeds and no ivy in sight. So did you know that there once stood a world-class museum of modern art on Windsor Avenue? Now, to a passerby, it might seem like every other row home on that block. They might be Victorian twins. I don't actually totally remember. But if sculptor Earl Wilkie opened his door, dropped the needle on a jazz record and led you through three stories of his original wooden sculptures, if you sniffed that old sawdust, saw those small twigs he had stopped whittling halfway through, or these grand tree trunks that tickled his ceiling with their smooth, buttery carvings. The Sistine Chapel was only a ceiling. Earl Wilkie's home required you to step around, to navigate, to squint and lean in close, to stand on tiptoe and catch the curve of the carve of the tippy top. And the effect was like having the Museum of Art all to yourself, except in the art museum, there's only completed works without the artist there to tell. Did you ever get box seats to the superb ballet company in residence on the South Street Bridge above the Schuylkill? Admittedly, their seasons were unplanned, performance calendar unpredictable, and seeing as they had no marketing materials to disseminate, they were easy to miss. Impressively, their executive leadership, board of director, administrative team, development officer, choreographers, and core dance ensemble consisted entirely of one unpaid woman, Kathy Chang, later Kathy Change, My front row seat was the passenger side on Mom's morning commute. Kathy Change waved silk flags for peace, marijuana legalization, and nuclear disarmament, using balletic swirls, kicks, leaps, and spirals. And you know, if she was still with us today, she'd be out there dancing for our global neighbors in Ukraine. The bend in her back as she arched was graceful. Her shouted mantras disarming and mischievous. No disrespect to Stravinsky, but the Nutcracker seemed kind of like pageantry compared to Kathy Change's fusion of ballet and protest. Ginger Rogers did it backward and in heels. Kathy Change did it barefoot and in the rain. In my adolescence, I chased her down in Clark Park to fan out. I love you, Miss Chang. I'm your biggest fan. You're amazing. Though I saw her perform hundreds of times over the years, that compliment was the only form of payment she accepted from me. And my sales receipt, or ticket stub, if you will, was her smile. Did you know there was a magnificent operatic arena rivaling the best of ancient Italy at Front Street and Hunting Park? Sure, the sign there says Green Mount Cemetery, and the rows of headstones punctuated by old growth trees might imply one should proceed in quiet. But on Mother's Day, back in the early aughts, that's when you'd hear Joaquin Rivera, a Philly Rican trovador, singing classic boleros of nostalgia to the ghosts of our forebears. The sound engineer, AKA Mother Nature, had created magnificent acoustics masquerading as grassy hillsides. And accompanying Joaquin on guitar was a symphony orchestra of pigeons and goldfinches. Adi Mukumba, Earl Wilkie, Kathy Change, Joaquin Rivera. One was an ex-con, one a university professor, one a self-immolator protesting war in the Middle East, and one died of a heart attack after waiting 45 minutes in a negligent emergency room. All were artists. All were our neighbors. So I invoke their legacies and life work today. I name them here in this institution because thanks to them, this whole city was my free library of Philadelphia. So my Philly neighbors, we are each other's most valuable collection. After 2 years of isolation, may we return to the street corner with ears ready to listen, free of charge. And may we bravely remove the armor from our still broken hearts, and free of charge may we share, which is what Lilliam and I are gonna do right now in conversation.
Wow, what a blessing. What a blessing. I don't know. I feel like I'm just really lucky. Thank you so much even just to have me, to invite me to Philly. I'm a Bronx girl. Don't hold that out on me. You know, I come in peace. first of all, before I say anything, I just want to say I first learned about your work watching a play held in Los Angeles. And a friend of mine, Carolina, who works for the LA Times, was like, I have an extra ticket. Do you want to go see this play? I think you'd like it. And she took me, and I don't even think Carolina was there because I became just immersed in this world that you created, that I was crying. I was laughing. I knew these people that were on stage. I knew them all. They were family. And this is how I feel. I felt again the same feeling when I read your book, when I read your memoir, and I mentioned it to you earlier, is that there were moments when I read it that I had to sit down and pause because it was so real and honest to me that the emotions I was feeling was too much for me. It overwhelmed me at times. And I knew them. I knew this family so well. So before anything, I just want to say thank you for sharing these truths with us, to finding a way of embodying all of this and just being able to write them in the sentences, and I could go back and I could highlight them as I go along. So thank I you, appreciate Lilliam. You and thank you for having me. So as a good journalist, I wrote questions. But Kiara and I are going to have a conversation, so we're just going to go off. But the first question I do want us to talk about first is, and this is something, a homecoming for you, right? writing this memoir, like, how, what was it like for you to time travel back through these episodes of time, you know, periods of time in your life where were really painful or really full of joy? But what was it like time traveling as you were writing this memoir?
Well, in some ways, like remembering the artists that I mentioned, and some of them are mentioned in the book too, not all of them. And I didn't mention all of the artists. It would have taken too long. It's humbling. It's a joy, you know, because you realize a lot of it is about the suffering, no doubt. It was the 80s and 90s in Philly. You know, let's be real. Mm-hmm. It was, there was a lot of struggle. Some of that has changed and morphed. Some of that has gone away. Some of it's still around. But the cool thing was, and this is why I knew I wanted to write the book, was there was a lot of joy too, and a lot of generosity, a lot of celebration. And to go back and really force myself to remember very specifically, to be in the scenes where on 4th of July, we danced like no one else in the world even knew what the word joy meant, except for us. Like, we had that in our hips. We had that in our hearts. Maybe I didn't have it in my hips. I was like the not great dancer of the family, but it was awesome to behold. That's that scene in the 4th of July of watching my beautiful cousins dance was when I said, oh, I got to write this book. And then what happened was, is I was, so I wrote that scene. And then what I remembered was, that scene was the year Bachata Rosa came out. So that's 1991. That's how I was able to remember the time, because I remember what we were dancing to. It was the new tape. And then I remember what 1991 was in our family, which was not a great year for us. There was a lot of loss that year. And I said, how could it be? How could we have danced? Honestly, probably as joyous as I remember any celebration of ours, how could we have danced like that in that hard time? And then I knew I had to write the book. Because I felt like my family, the Perez family, had something to teach this nation about survival and embodied grief. So that's what it was like to time travel back. It was kind of to live in those generous, beautiful spaces, but to also feel the backdrop of the cost of those political times of upheaval. You know, it was HIV days, it was war on drugs days, and so the as far as HIV goes, the nation was telling one story about it, which is, you know, it was very homophobic. But it was also, Latinos were not part of that picture. You wouldn't even know Latinos had anything to do with HIV AIDS, but that was not my experience or my reality. So I'm like, where's the stories on us? Like, I was looking for research to write this book. I still couldn't find it.
Still couldn't find it.
I had to dig real deep, you know. And on the other hand, with the war on drugs and everything, this, when we were out there in the stories, it was an ugly, unfair picture, and it was not real. So, you know, I went back and tried to be in it for real again.
So you, and of course, you. This is the thing about the memoir is that, yes, it's a topic about language and, you know, and how we communicate and the women and the fierceness of all of that. But I also felt there was a lot about this idea of finding joy within, you know, and music pulsated throughout all the chapters. And first of all, I wanted to, the playlist. Does that exist?
I have to Spotify that or something, yeah.
And secondly, it's just this idea, for me, personally, music will always be the salvation, will always be what saves me. Like, I could document my family's history through that music, through the concerts, through whatever album that was playing. And I feel that it's almost the same thing for you. So did you go back and realize this type of music? Do you see it in a different way now going back?
I still listen to it, and I hear it new each all the time, and I relate to that. It's funny because the boy, as I mentioned earlier, he remembers, he's like, oh no, that has to be, you know, 2000 because Iverson was down by 3 points in that quarter. Like, he remembers that.
A different thing. You know,
but it's like actually not so different because I'm like, right, that was the year when Bobby Cespedes came out with Que Viva Chango. And so we were all freaking out because there was a new version of Que Viva Chango out. Like, I can remember the chronology through that. You know, in some ways, I think one of the reasons, I didn't start out as a writer, though I was always writing, I was pursuing musical studies. And on the street corner at Settlement Music School, at my Aunt Linda's house. And I think one of the great things that music can do a little bit better than words a lot of the time is syncopation, right? Mm-hmm. Like, there is always tension and release in music. And that's what gets us excited as we listen. And that's how, that matches how my heart feels. That matches how it feels inside. But words want to go together a little more fluently. This was something I grappled with in writing the book. How can I get that syncopation, that tension and release of all my different selves battling inside?
Well, I mean, I feel that's, and I don't know if this is, it's a Latina thing, but when I'm writing, that's how I'm thinking of how it's like the rhythm of the word, of the sentences and the rhythm of dialogue. I mean, to me, it's music. Mm-hmm. And I don't know if you're doing that when you were writing, were you reading it out loud? It's almost like it's, you know, these are incantations that you're saying. These are songs that you're stating, even if they're sentences, even if it's prose.
Do you read it out? Do you when you're writing?
I do.
Yeah, me too.
Yeah, like I feel like I have to.
Yeah.
And also, it just, if I don't sound, if I'm writing about the Bronx, if I don't sound Bronx, then someone's going to call me out. Right? So, and we don't want that. So, but you know, it's important. It's the musicality. And like, and I don't know if other writers do that, you know, if they're really finding the rhythm of, you know, the dialogue of things. Like, to me, it's really important.
Well, I know. I mean, I'm jumping. I got to see these questions ahead of time. They're very good. And and I'm jumping ahead to one of the other questions now. But it's like, okay, so what were you reading when you're working on it? And I was reading memoirs that not just put me in a different person's life, but that put me in a different person's music and language, you know? Mm. So some of them were rereads for me, but I saw it in a whole different way. Like going back to Piri Tomas. Mm-hmm. What's the book, the famous book by Piri? Thank you, Down These Mean Streets. you know, and the language is just, it's nasty, man. It's nasty, it's so good. You know, and the James Baldwin, and just where the language is so urgent and musical.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like when you get to, when you're near a waterfall and it's loud, you gotta be quiet, you know? It's that powerful. It's a force of nature. And so, yeah, I was reading stuff especially like that.
I feel like with Piri, it's like that was a big deal for me. When someone, whoever gave me a copy of that was profound.
When was it?
I must have been too young to read it. And, you know, I must have been 11 years old or something. And I just felt there was something a little bit dangerous about it. It's something sacred. I'm sure my parents were not, my parents would read the Bible to me, and I felt, to me, that was something musical about that too. But with Piri, that's something about that really connected with my family in some way.
Absolutely. Like,
and it was a freeing thing, right? Because at that moment you felt, oh, I could write that story, you know, like a little seed.
I hoped. I mean, I was like, the bar was set, you know, when I reread it. And towards the end of the book, he's, spoiler alert, in prison, and he starts to voraciously read. And so he has this line a few chapters before the end, and as he's reading about philosophy, he's reading whatever's in the prison library, and he's reading about psychology. So he's starting to understand his adolescent sense of rage and confusion and loneliness in a different way. He's gaining vocabulary for these experiences he's had. And he says, I began to dig what was inside me, you know? And I'm like, it's such a perfect sentence because he was digging like a gardener, you know? But he was also digging like a Bronx cat, you know, and I was like, that's my book. That's what a memoir is, right? I began to dig what was inside me. That's it. That's the plot of most memoirs in one sentence. You know,
That's all you need for the back of the book is that.
Yeah.
So we all know that My Broken Language is a love letter to Philly. And for me, you know, I don't know Philly. So to me, I'm reading the book and I'm like, oh, these are the places I'm supposed to be going to visit. Like, I'm like making my list, tour guide. So was it easy is there a place now that you feel that you turn to again and again when you come home? Like, is there still, besides mom's home?
Yeah, that's the main one.
Right.
You know, it's like the people. It does go back to the people. I do still drive by. You know, it's funny. I still drive by my old block the 800 block of St. Bernard Street. I still drive by it. And we're not there anymore. But it doesn't look any different. It looks the same. Those houses were built to last. You know, I think the thing that feels most distinctly Philly to me is the gardens, the North Philly gardens. Mm. And I do get to, Power Street Theater does some programming in Las Parcelas. You know, but it's a cool notion that some old chicks who were farmers back in Puerto Rico could come with all their knowledge and find where the empty lots were and get some truckloads of dirt brought in and make some gardens in Philly. Mm-hmm. It's like when you migrate, a lot migrates with you. Mm. I mean, the gardens migrated with them. And so that to me is very distinctly Philly. I'm sure that is in New York too, but I know the women who got that dirt under their fingernails.
That's the most powerful thing, that idea of even creating a garden and translating it, you know, transporting it and also translating it to new ground here and making it something new. And it's the most powerful thing to do is be able to grow something.
I just remembered, you know, in the last 2 years, like potted plants have trended because of the pandemic.
Plant,
you know,
mamas.
So people are propagating. I have my friend, I have a playwright friend, Amy Herzog, she propagates plants and gives them to me. They're beautiful plants. But I'm like, man, if Titi Ginny, she'd be just smirking. She'd be like, I did that. Like, you would go, her kitchen was like mason jars full of leaves and stuff. And, you know, she was always growing so much. And so that was with the North Square Neighborhood Project. And I'm sure there were other organizations involved. Mm. And I don't know all the machinery involved in that. But, you know, all those organizations were founded by individual people who just held hands and were like, let's do this crazy idea this weekend, you know.
Well, let's talk about, or I want to say this one thing before we continue, which is one of the most powerful things that I read was the chapter titled Serenity Prayer. Mm. It's on page 224. It had me crying, and only because personally, you know, I'm a sober person. I've been sober for like 20 years, and alcoholism and sobriety is not a conversation that I can flowly have with my family. You know, it's just not something that we talk about, even though it's always prevalent in all my work. So when I read that, it felt like such a jarring thing to see on paper, because I still felt in my head that this is a sacred and a secret thing that I keep to myself. Mm. To see it like in print, it floored me so much that I had, you know, I was crying. Mm. But it came at a moment when I needed to hear it. It was a reminder of, you know, it was a reminder of like, we suffer, but we don't suffer alone, you know.
I love that.
I just wanted to say, and this is something that I feel like we have to have a conversation about, is how do we reconcile being like kind of the translator of for our family in a lot of ways when we're writing creatively, when we're writing, you know, I write fiction. Of course, I'm digging right into what my family have, you know, what they go through. Never look back, obviously, Hurricane Maria. But sometimes I feel like, do I have the right to do that? You know?
Yeah. I think it's urgent. I think it's an imperative. You know, they talk about the violence of the archive. Mm. And erasure is part of that violence. There's also just the happenstance of the archive. Our archive is tricky because it's in different languages, and one language is more dominant depending on where your feet happen to be at that moment. Mm-hmm. So there's also trickiness. There's, you know, colonization of the archive. So the only way to address, you know, these things is to create the archive, to be the archive, to pass the baton, because you cannot do it alone, and I cannot do it. I have no right to represent the entire community alone.
Right.
That must be a joint effort. Mm-hmm. It requires a lot of voices. It requires a lot of writers. So it is imperative. In terms of, you know, but it's hard. It's hard, especially when you get to painful stuff,
mm-hmm.
right? In the particular instance of the Serenity Prayer, the reason I included that chapter was because when my cousin went through recovery and was successful at it and is to this day and is very impressive. It's been decades now, like yourself. Congratulations. There's this notion of the rags to riches story. It's like some like American dream kind of story. And, you know, I was so skeptical of it for many reasons growing up, but especially seeing her triumph through her being clean, because, you know, I'm like the one who kind of like made it. And that's supposed to be the triumph story. But I found her grace and humility that is required for that I witnessed every day to stay clean. That was really triumphant. Mm-hmm. That seemed very hard to me.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, and I find that applause is for her. And there was a point in the book where I say, I had a writing teacher who said, okay, list all your identities. And I wrote my list, and I looked at my list. I said, okay, that's me and that's me, but what are all these other traits? These are my loved ones' traits. Mm. And I realized at that point, I said, oh, my cousins, and by extension, really, the realization there was that my female relatives especially, they were that of God within me.
Mm.
There's a Quaker component to the story too, and to my life also, right? So my cousins were that of God within me. Mm. So I don't know where the boundary between this cousin ends and that cousin begins. And I've made mistakes. I certainly have. But I think I've also, you know, hearing other people around the country read these stories and say they're heroes. They're amazing women. I'm like, that's right. But we got to be real. We got to write our ups and downs. You know, you're not a hero if everything's peachy and rosy. What's that? That's a lie. So,
right,
you
right,
know.
Right.
So listen, I wrote questions too. Okay.
We're professional here.
Can I ask some?
Sure.
Well, the thing is, you have to hold your book up because it's a beautiful cover. Never look back.
Minus the mask.
Thank you. And it's about many things, but part of it is set and addresses the Hurricane Maria. And it's set in a mythological framework. So there's Orpheus and Eurydice. It's dealing with this kind of Greek. So I was floored. I was like, I'm not the only one dealing with these kind of mythological components. I was so excited about that. And then there's Ato, who is how I would characterize is he's a really dangerous guardian. He's a spirit. These are characters in the spirit world. There's characters in this flesh and blood world too in her book. But I thought this dangerous guardian, it really freaked me out and scared me. So I wanted to ask you some questions about, since I'm dealing with mythology,
yes,
and with spiritual energies and with natural energies, and you're doing the same in your book, I wanted to ask some questions about that. But maybe first, can we share a few words from our books about those topics?
Yeah. I love that you asked me to do that. So I'll just read a little bit. It's told in alternating points of view. So you have Yuri, who left Puerto Rico because of Hurricane Maria, who's being followed by Ato, the spirit. And Fierce, who's a wannabe bachata singer who woos the girls, but, you know, ends up falling in love with Yuri. But here he is in La Casitas, and he has to go look for her because she has been taken away by Ato. And this is what Fierce has to
say when he's dealing with people who are leaders in this kind of spiritual space. What is a spirit if not the result of a colonized traumatic state? The man with the beard says, plant yourself in the mindset of the Taínos when they first saw the conquistadores arriving on the island. They were seeing things they never witnessed before, so much pain, and then this pain can manifest in many ways. They talk to me with calm voices, but what they're saying sounds impossible. I'm meant to be open, but how can I be when what they speak of is straight out of a horror movie? I'm dealing with a history of tragedy that goes back centuries. But how can I help her, I ask. Doña Petra shakes her head. You can't. Then why am I even here? I head to the door. This is some bullshit. Why did Pops bring me here if the only thing these people will offer me is a history lesson? Don't tell me about the why. I don't need to know how. Give me the tools. If not, get out of my way. My father presses his hand on my chest, preventing me from leaving. He believes there is still time, Pop says. His heart is true. I've seen them, Yuri and Fierce. I know they were meant to stand beside each other. Let him try. You abandoned her once, Doña Petra says. You're too young to see what's playing. You should go back to singing at the club for your friends. It's an easier life. I push Pops away. Screw this. I'll find another way. Wait. Doña Petra approaches me with an intense stare I cannot hold. There's only one way to help Yuri, but the entrance to El Inframundo will not be cheap. What are you willing to give up? I don't have much, I say. I barely have an education. My father doesn't have a job. I'm broke. Dig deep, Doña Petra says, because your love will not be enough. Your anger will not be enough. What do you have of value compared to a tempestuous spirit who came from a world filled with suffering? He can sing, my father says. She's right, though. I ain't nothing. But what else do I have to offer? Let me try, I say. Please. Aww.
Okay, so just as a little background info on this, early in the book, in kindergarten, I decided to drop my middle name because my first and last name was difficult enough. And the kindergartners were giving me hell about Alegría, so I'm like, let me get rid of that. So I just became Kiara Hudes. And now I'm an adolescent, a preteen. Okay. What's Aina Lode, Mom? I asked her the afternoon I received protective spiritual beads. My clothes and hair were still a bit damp from the limpieza, and I slowly pulled slender pom-pom petals from behind my ears. Is Aina Lode like God bless you? Is it the same as bendición? Since all the priests and priestesses there addressed Mom with the word, I figured they were bestowing Ache or something. I am Aina Lode, she laughed gently. Aina Lode is me. That's the name I was given when I was crowned with Jangol. Everyone who does santo receives a name. So, Tia Tonya and Titi Margi, do they have Ocha names? I asked. Those were two of Mom's older sisters who were also advanced in the religion. Yes, Mom said, carefully peeling a tiny flower petal from my clavicle. Tia Tonya is Obanyoko. Titi Margi is Ochaleri. And she asked me to repeat, checking my pronunciation, as she lifted the shoulder strap of my training bra and pulled a flower bit from beneath it. Her smooth acrylic tips gave me chills as she fished away the petals. I observed how Mom greeted her godfather, Padrino Julio, at the front door, but the second he put on that white ceremonial cap, he became Baba Funke. Testing the waters, I approached her other godfather. Padrino Tony, what is your Ocha name? Oluchande, he told me. Oluchande, I repeated. It felt marvelous to say. And as he smiled, I realized I had dropped my middle name years ago, fatigued by its difference. Meanwhile, this circle welcomed the complexity of new names in new languages. Time to pay attention, Kiki. Time to ask if you can accompany Mom to the next tumbao or bembe.
I love that.
So I want to ask you, Liliam, about mythology and the spirit world. And, you know, I made this assertion in the book that because when I got to grad school and I was writing with the Odisha in mind, my colleagues there were saying, it's like you're writing about the Greek gods. Mm-hmm. And in the book, I make this assertion, well, the Greek gods were then and the Odisha are now. But this really cool classic scholar, Daniel Padilla Peralta, who teaches at Princeton, he has challenged me on that. And he said, no, the Greek gods are also now. Mm-hmm. And he is a Black Dominican Haitian scholar who's dealing in these worlds really deep. Mm. And I was like, oh, my God, okay. Teach me. So I'm curious, because you're adapting Orpheus and Eurydice. Tell me about how the Greeks are now.
I mean, I don't think there's original story. I think we're all saying this, the story is being repeated again and again. And so for me, the Orpheus and Eurydice story is just something that I'm sure was passed down and passed down, like just reinterpreted and retold, you know, even in Puerto Rico. And honestly, I needed that structure. I needed the structure because I was filled with such grief and such overwhelming rage at what the government was lacking or not doing for Puerto Rico at the time when Hurricane Maria happened. And you know, and I would travel, you know, I was promoting some book and I would travel places and things were happening. I was missing an uncle we couldn't get a hold of him because of, you know, we just couldn't. And we went to social media and did all that just to find him. Luckily, a DJ found him for us, you know, and it's just like this idea
on
of
the radio saying, are you there?
He literally was driving around the island and we gave him coordinates. And he found him for us. And it's just this idea, this person who didn't know us from anywhere, you know. But how do I write about grief and pain without me being like, I hate everything. I want to burn everything down. You know, I didn't want to write that YA book. You know, I wanted to find a way of controlling this rage and grief and pain. And I used that structure of Orpheus and Eurydice. And also because I grew up watching Black Orpheus. And if you ever watch that movie, I watched that really young in the projects in the Bronx, and that movie changed my life. And I knew that I could find a way of these two young characters have to die and relive again, you know? Like they have to release something, you know? And maybe, you know, personally, I probably had to release a lot of rage. You know, but the Greek ideas like these, there's always this, I got a lot of this, and I don't know if you get this too, is that a lot of people say, well, you're touching on these big, you know, the Greek. And I'm like, the Taínos, I'm sure, had a lot of stories that were amazing that maybe weren't written down, or maybe were written on a wall, or were orally told, and are just as powerful. You know, I just feel like you could find these gods everywhere. And to me, that it's just easier. It wasn't easier. It's just, I just feel like it's a conversation that's being told and having and this conversation that's being repeated again and again through generations.
And what about Ato? So we have the structure of Orpheus and Eurydice. What about Ato, who is this spirit who comes to Yuri when she is in a moment of profound loss? And as she's a child, and stays with her, and plants the seeds of her imagination, comforts her, is her playmate. But then, as her kind of protector, and it gets dark, and he gets controlling of her, and it really kind of becomes abusive, and he becomes almost like her soul is his battery, so he needs her to operate. So what's can you tell me about the kind of traditions that informed Ato?
So this is the thing that, you know, we were talking about earlier, is that you write something and you don't know what you're writing about. I really believe that I was writing about pain and the pain that stuff like an island suffers, you know, there's fingerprints, like everything that's built, even this building, there's someone, you know, there's blood and fingers here, throughout. You know, I believe in ghosts. I believe in spirits, you know. But when I'm writing, you know, something, I don't really know what I'm writing about until afterwards. And then it dawns on me at one point, maybe when you're having a conversation with someone and you're like, oh, wait a minute, I'm really writing about this. And I was really writing about, you know, an abusive relationship that I was in, you know. And I don't think I never even shared it with anyone, ever. You know, it was just something that so many things happen in women's lives, you know. One other thing that you had to talk about. But then after I wrote the book and after it published and you talk about it, like, oh, here it is. Where's Ato? I understand where he's coming from. He's from this abusive relationship that has haunted me for so long that now I have to write it on the page, you know, to exercise it.
I think it's really scary. For me, it was a very scary part of the book. You know, purposefully. This is, you know, it's a thriller, in some regards. But just the notion that someone that loves you and helps you grow so much can also, in the end, really try to kill you.
Yeah.
You know, that was really scary. That was really scary. And I think you pulled that off very well. So how do you, when you're dealing with these dark energies, writing, like, how do you protect yourself?
I know, because this is the question. I'm going to ask you, what do you do?
Tell me. I think this has to be our last question.
Yeah.
Let's talk about protecting ourselves.
Yeah, protecting ourselves. Well, you know, because it was a painful thing to write, I went to therapy. Amen. You know, and I really did start very much practicing meditation, therapy. I'll try anything. I'll connect with you know, AA has always been my thing for me since I've been sober, so I go to AA all the time. But after writing this, I really needed to hype it up, you know, like heighten it all up to get those tools in place. Yeah. And I dance a lot. Did you dance a lot? I don't know. I dance a lot. I was taking bachata lessons online as I was writing this book.
I love that. I had to, you know, I was actually taking a break from theater. I had been a playwright for 20 years. It had started to take a toll, just like y'all know, you do something for 20 years, it becomes a grind. It can be very hard. And so I needed to take a break. And so writing the book was my break. There's a realization I have in the book, which was because we started out, as I mentioned, we were farmers back in Puerto Rico. And when your roots is farming and all of a sudden you're in Philly, by the art museum, there was old growth trees. But then, you know, after a few decades of gentrification, you're deep north and there's not old growth trees on your block. Like what does a farming person do when it's only cement? And I was like, our bodies. That was our plot of land, our bodies. Then it made sense. That's why we were able to dance like that at that 4th of July, because we knew we were farmers and this was our land. And so I knew I had to, it's very easy for me to just be here. This is me. This is Kiara right here. But I knew in writing a book about our bodies, I had to, you know, try to get rid of that. So I also did therapy, but it was a lot of prayer. I was like actively praying more than I usually do. A lot of walking, just trying to be in my body constantly, which was also a good practice of wellness. Eat well. I ate ginger all the time. Me and the ginger was like, and I reconnected with the ancestors in new ways and learned new ways to speak to them, which was very helpful.
So we're going to be, if you have a question, raise your hand. I will point at you and we'll get a mic to you. So ask a question, whatever you want.
Oh, thank you. First of all, I want to say, ladies, lovely, lovely book.
Thank you.
I am a Castle Hill Bronx transplant to Philly.
Hey.
So I grew up in New York City, went to college in D.C., married a dude from Richard Allen Projects and moved to Philly.
Yes.
Raised my family on Larchwood and 47th Street.
Hey.
So I know, I fed that brother a lot of times. And
yes.
So when I read your book in particular, since I'm a Philly transplant, but I've been here 34 years, you know, so, and I'm going to die here, I'm not, and, you know. not going anywhere. And so I consider myself a Philadelphia girl, and I'm a library. I've had a library card for 53 years. Yes. I had a Philly library card for 28, and the rest was the Bronx, Brooklyn free library card, New York City. So Lillian, I want to say that I appreciate, and not just your genius in your book, but the fact that you were willing to be vulnerable, because there are a lot of young people, brown folks, male and female, who need to know that that does happen. It's not just them. Mm-hmm. Who need to know that people who they thought were protecting them when they were growing up, this can get toxic, and it's not their fault. Mm-hmm. That they need to know to get out, tell somebody else. So thank you.
Thank you. Thank you so much.
And sister girl, I gotta tell you, I did not know you was all that you were when I was reading your book, right? First of all, I love your name. And because when I got your book, I was in one field, and I was telling some of the folks that are, you know, some of my friends that were still in West Philly over there on Bernard Street, they was like, oh, I know her mother. I know her mother. I was like, for real? How about this that? I guess I'm not a real Philly person because, you know, and my kids are a little bit younger than you are, so I didn't really. Some folks that knew your family, I appreciate the fact that you wrote your memoirs, though, because I am Trinidadian by way of the Bronx to Philly, and we never considered ourselves immigrants because my father's family is from the South. Mm-hmm. Well, when I read your story about broken language, I had a lot of understanding in that.
Cool.
So again, I appreciate you digging down, and a lot of my family is Yoruba, so I appreciate you giving us your vulnerability on paper.
Thank you.
Thank you. Do we have, a question here? They're in the middle.
That was a hard act to follow. Would each of you say a word or two about how important is suffering to creativity?
Oh. Okay, I'll jump in. I've been thinking about this a lot.
I know.
Because one thing that kind of like irks me is, you know, how people are like, oh, that actor, you know, they're not together. Or like people criticize artists a lot for like being messed up and messy. Mm. It's like, what do you want from us? I'm sorry. Do you want your artists like well adjusted and like, but how much do you have to suffer? You have to suffer as much as every human alive. That's the answer. You have to suffer as much as thorny as your path is, that's how much you get scratched. And the thing about artists is, you know, humans are great at resiliency and coming up with adaptations to still, you know, get their kids to school in time, even though they're scratched. You know what I'm saying? To take care of their sick father, even though they're scratched. But artists just have to like put that armor aside, as I mentioned in my remarks, and they have to go, they just have to live in that suffering space a little more presently. But it's not more than, you know, it's just that we have to find a home in that space. So then we have to find practices of wellness too. So that
could you be as creative without having that?
I don't know what the alternate path is. What do you think?
Well, I will say this, because I write for kids, for young adults, and I feel like sometimes there is an emphasis of brown and black pain to sell, that the stories have to be that. And I'm here to say that no, that there could be joy, and there could be books about complete joy, and there could be books about, you know, pain as well. That there could be both, that we don't have to be either or. It could just be, you know, I could write a heist story that's silly and funny and sexy or whatever, and I could also write about something that's a retelling that's a little bit more deeper and more personal. I could do both.
Yeah.
Hi, thank you so much for this. Kiara, I just want to say I came to United States. I'm from Puerto Rico, too. Whoop, whoop!
Hey, hey.
I came as an adult. And I met a boy here as well, and so here I am 22 years later. And I have two kids, and thank you for your book. Ooh, I'm going to get emotional. Because sometimes when you're raising kids here, you kind of, they adopt the culture here completely, and you kind of stay in the background a little bit. And your story of your mom inspired me to hype it up. And
yes. Hype it up.
just to make sure my kids know where they're coming from and who they are. So thank you, thank you. And your story made me understand, it helped me understand more who they are as growing up double cultured. So Thank you very much for your book.
Thanks, I'm so glad to
thank
hear that.
You. Thank you. There was a question over here. And I just want to say that I had a lot of questions for just about her mother, and I think we would have to have a separate event just to dedicate for her mother, who's an amazing powerhouse. Okay.
So I think my question kind of goes with what she's saying, and I'm going to probably get emotional too. So, Kiara, you and I have very parallel lives. We're 2 years apart, and reading your novel, I saw you went to Friends Central, I went to Masterman, so we probably hung out here after school at the same time and never even knew each other. But my mom was the librarian at Six and Lehigh, and I grew up in that library, and it was, I didn't have books to read about people like me, and so I had Nicolás Amor. And that was it. And I only got those books because my mom found them for me in New York. And she gave me P.D. Thomas when I was probably way too young to read it because I had no Puerto Rican authors to read. And now I also have children here in, you know, being raised in Philadelphia. And her being frustrated as a kid, also not having enough to read. And so... Lillian, she's read one of your books, and we're about to read the other one. She's so excited. There's a story about bachata. And and Greek mythology, which is her other favorite thing. So, like, she's just like, this woman sees into my soul. And she's about to go to New York City, actually, to study film and screenwriting. And her what she wrote about was about the fact that she wanted to produce things for children, Latinas, that are growing up in the States and have stories, you know, reflecting themselves. So my question for both of you is, who were your favorite authors growing up? Who did you look to for, you know, for guidance in sort of in your inspiring you to then become authors?
Well, a turning point for me, and it's in my book, is when I read Shange for Colored Girls Who Have Considered Suicide When the Rainbow Is Enough. And the reason that was a turning point for me, I've read so many books I loved. The reason that was a big one for me is because she was dealing with a sort of a kind of spiritual reality that spoke straight to my heart. When she talked in the end, now I was familiar with laying on of hands in the biblical sense, but that felt a little bit distant for me. I was really familiar with laying on of hands because my we healed each other in my family. Literally, my mom, I talk about my mom was giving abuela a scoliosis massage and discovered her scar from the, you know, coerced sterilization. Like, we laid on hands. Right? My cousin Kuka helped me when I got my first period. Like, she was like with the clean panties and like TMI, but this is what it is. This is what it is when you come to, you know? But it was a laying on of hands. But that was just normal for me. I didn't think of it as something special, as something that I carried with me and as something that was my responsibility to therefore pass on. But when Shange said in her play that she needed, you know, the laying on of hands, she was missing something. She was missing her own spirit coming into its own, and she needed a laying on of hands to get there. I said, oh my God, she just described my reality, but I didn't even know. It was too close for me to even see it, and she described it. So that was a big turning point for me.
Well, I think for me was when I didn't get to read anyone really powerful until
until college. That's when I read Sandra Cisneros. I think we all go through like a Sandra Cisneros moment.
Oh, yeah.
And so when I finally discovered her, and I was just like, why wasn't she here before? Like, why wasn't it in my book, in my library books? And so reading her was like, it was Sandra Cisneros, and then it became Beloved, Toni Morrison. Those are the two books that just, I don't know, it just changed everything for me. And I was just like, maybe I could write. You know, that was like the inkling of maybe I could do it, you know, really when I read those books. But I had to wait for college for that to happen.
Thank you. Just like everyone else who's gotten a chance to speak, thank you so much for bringing the Latinx voice into the conversation. I also grew up born in Venezuela, family Peruvian, brought here at 1 year old, and never got to read about people like me. And getting that chance has been amazing. And kind of an interesting question, I guess, would be how have both of you been able to bring together that question that I feel like a lot of us have, immigrants from all backgrounds, of am I Peruvian enough? Am I American enough? Am I Puerto Rican enough? Am I American enough? Mm-hmm. How have you been able to consolidate those thoughts together into one?
You know, hearing you say it like that... I don't know. This might be the wrong answer, but hearing you say it like that, I'm like, no, you're none of those things enough. Therefore, the only thing you are enough is you.
Mm-hmm.
You are you enough. And so that's what you must cultivate. Mm-hmm. And parts of all of those beautiful cultures and worlds you listed are there. And they're going to come forth too. And no one can check your box. You know what I'm saying? Mm. So I find great peace and freedom in that for myself. And hearing you say, am I this enough? Am I that enough? It's like, no, not to satisfy someone else's needs, you know, but for you inside, yes.
Yeah, and I agree. Well, I think that's all the time we have. I know something's going to happen. We're going to listen to music. yes, and I'm excited for that. But thank you so much, and let's thank our favorite person, Yara.
We're now delighted to welcome students from the Curtis Institute of Music to the stage for the premiere of an original work inspired by My Broken Language. The Curtis Institute has graciously partnered with the library, and we thank them for bringing their talented composers and musicians to the One Book Experience. Different Universes was composed by Leah Amick and a student at the Curtis Institute of Music, whose compositions have been performed by the Curtis Symphony Orchestra, the Boulder Philharmonic, the Orlando Philharmonic, and the Indiana University New Music Ensemble, and others. Recently, a one-act chamber opera for which Leah wrote both the libretto and music was premiered by the New Voices Opera. Different Universes is performed this evening by Curtis students, Dave Tarantino on the marimba and Alan Liu on guitar. Please join me in warmly welcoming them to the stage.
Thank you.